this is not the issue.
This is not the issue. This is not
this
the,
is
point.
Not the
that's,
issue. The fact
that's the
that,
most important
you know,
point,
it's not
yeah.
that I don't feel anything.
No,
it's the fact that this is not the point.
Point.
That, you know, I'm coming or there's going to
no,
be, you know.
No.
The point is, you know, the people and having justice and establishing
yes,
justice.
That's right.
So he goes to the he goes to Beit Zara.
Yes.
He has that famous speech, which, you know, just thinking about it, I'm just, you know, you just get
yeah,
emotional
yeah.
because oh, you the speech starts with the children. There's a children's choir and they're singing this very famous song, which
yes.
is in Iran is famous, mm-hmm. talking about the martyrs. And well, anyways, I mean, this was a it's a very moving and emotional thing. And then he starts talking and he says, you know, this is, you remember, 80-year-old Grand Ayatollah.
Exactly.
He says, we will punch this government in the mouth.
That's right.
We will establish our own government. So, remember, all of this in the context of coup d'etat, you know, killing, executions, this is all
that's
being
right.
threatened.
Right.
So he goes and he stays in Rome at first. And what does the Bakhtiar government do? They issue martial law. They proclaim
do.
Martial law.
That's true.
Which is what all
yes, of course.
Oppressors do,
do
at some point.
At some point.
Which is that people are not allowed to be in the streets after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This was the martial law. And anybody there without permission with
will
a
be shot.
Will be shot.
Yes.
Remember, will be shot.
Shot. And this comes in the background, of course.
And people lost lives because of this. They had
yeah.
to go to the hospital. They couldn't go to the hospital.
Exactly.
People, you know, needing medication. Could.
Sure.
So this is, it's real.
Because
it's not
I wanted to put it in the context.
This because during the time of the Shah, the Shah
yeah,
would do
this.
Yeah,
that's right. This is what I wanted
this
to mention.
Would, you know,
in 1963, for example.
Right.
Yeah,
so this
yeah.
was not something, you know, we, you know, people knew what this
people
meant.
People knew what this meant.
Okay.
This is serious.
Serious stuff.
Hmm.
So what does Imam do? They say to him, well, it's martial law. What does Imam do? What does Imam say?
Mm-hmm.
Again, roaring lion.
Roaring lion.
Courage.
Back to that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He says, tell the people to go out.
Out.
This.
And knowing full well what the consequences
well,
are.
Well, people around him, I'm talking about people around him.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
even, you know,
yeah.
religious people, you know,
yeah,
revolutionaries,
yeah.
they folded. They said, well, what if the people get killed?
Killed.
You know, the blood will be on your hands.
Hands.
This, you know, these kind of,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah, sure.
threats and these kind
yeah,
of,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
underhanded.
Yes.
As though Imam doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
Right. So Imam's very calmly just says, tell the people to go out.
Oh.
And they went out. And that's it. That's when the revolution was successful.
Successful, yes.
Because the enemies, internally and externally, saw that there's nothing they can do.
Good.
No threat is going to scare this man. Okay?
Excellent.
And it's at that time when you see that within a couple of weeks, within a short period of time, the Bakhtiar government falls.
Falls, yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
And they talked about it in their interviews later on. I'm talking about the members of that
yeah.
of that government. We had a list of 500. We had already, you know, I'm talking about the Bakhtiar government,
yes,
not the military, which was supposed to do the coup d'etat and arrest everyone.
Right.
The Bakhtiar government itself, the people in that government, again, on the BBC, so people don't think we're making up stories
no,
here,
no.
came on and said, we had a list of 500 or 600 people. We already had the prison.
I saw the same program.
We had the prison ready in some
yeah.
far-off place. We were
yeah.
going to go and arrest everybody in one night
sure.
and take them to that camp and
mm-hmm.
decide what we're going to do with mm-hmm. them. And, you know, and we had the list of executions and so on. And so.
They did.
So, again, this shows the man, because we're talking about his extraordinary personality.
Well, of course we are.
His reliance on God. None of this could have happened for Imam. Imam could not have had that strength and that courage if he didn't believe in God.
No, of course.
If he didn't trust God completely.
Mm.
Okay? If he did not have complete faith and belief in the promises of God as is stated in the Quran. If he did not have complete trust and did not take as his model the model of the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Of course.
Of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Peace be upon him.
Okay? So, this is what we're trying to say here, which is that you have this man, the way that the Supreme Leader explains it, who was the same level that he was courageous and able to come out. He also spent the nights, you know, pleading and seeking grace from God.
Yes.
He derived his strength from that personal worship and that personal servitude to God, which then translated into his power against the enemies. This is an important lesson for Muslims.
It is, very much so.
Your power doesn't come from anything but God.
God. Absolutely.
And how do you tap that? You tap that by being a servant of God. Okay? We say it, it's easy to say.
It's easy to say.
But it's difficult to implement. You know, we all are. So don't, you know,
yeah,
when we
I
say
know.
These things,
I know.
We're
I
not
know.
Talking as though we've done this,
no.
you know, very
no.
well in our
My
own lives.
God.
But we at least
I wouldn't even want to venture there.
But at least we saw somebody who did.
Who did.
And there was Imam.
Mm.
And he will always be an example. And he will also be Hujjat. He will be
Hujjat, yes.
For us in the next world. In
the
sense that, I'm talking, could be against us. Allah will say to us, look, I sent somebody. He was your example. You
That's
could have
right.
followed.
Because the Holy Quran says that there is no time, no period that the world will not be without an Imam. Right? So
right.
Even though we are still waiting for the last savior to reappear, but you know this is no less
on a lesser degree
yeah.
we can say that somebody who lived in this time
yes
Allah can say to them, look,
yeah.
here was a man,
here was
he lived Islam, he was completely, it's interesting, Shahid Muhammad Baghir Sadr,
please,
the
yes.
famous martyr in from Najaf Hawza, Iraqi
yes
you know
yes,
who was one of the he's also one of those incredible
great
human
scholars.
Beings that just come along every couple
centuries. Yes.
He said, you know, immerse yourself into Imam and his teachings the way Imam immersed himself into Islam. Okay, this is his famous saying. Okay, so Imam was immersed in Islam.
Immersed.
And who says this? Shahid Asad says
this.
Okay, and he's saying, Shahid Asad is saying to his students and to the young people at that time and to the followers and to the He's saying, you know, look at the way Imam immersed himself in Islam. You immerse yourself in this life, in this teachings, in this example of the Imam. And it's interesting, Shahid Asad, who, according to, you know, everybody who was there in Najaf at that time, basically was a mujtahid from before he reached the age of taklif. So,
right.
you know, this is very rare.
Very rare.
It's very rare that somebody so young.
He was a genius.
He was a genius. Okay? He was certified genius.
He was.
Okay? So they asked him, by the time he was 15, 16, he was mujtahid, meaning he was a full ayatollah in terms of being able to issue fatwas.
Mm.
Very difficult. And a person like him has this to say about Imam. He says, if Imam ordered me to become a judge in some far-off village in Iran, I would do so in a heartbeat.
Mm.
Okay? This is a man who is a full, you know, full scholar in
yes.
all branches
yes.
of Islamic teachings, philosophy, fiqh, usul,
yes.
you know, history, a complete scholar at a young age, a genius.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
Because, you know, we've had that in our history. People like Ibn Sina, people
yes,
like
yes,
Allama Hilli.
I mean,
you know, we've had people
His works were even acknowledged in Paris, you know, because
right.
they even foresaw
so,
the
so
end of
So anybody who's
or?
Familiar with Shahid Muhammad Baghir Sadr
yes,
knows what we're talking about. And here's a man who says, if Imam ordered me, after this is after the revolution, and this is one of the reasons, this is the main reason they killed him.
Killed
him,
yes.
Saddam killed him, because
he did not
renounce and denounce
Imam
and the
yes.
revolution.
That's right.
Which was a major threat to Saddam, and then of course Saddam attacked.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and so you have somebody like Shahid Asad with this heavy scholarly weight, with this amazing, you know, talent and abilities, a real leader, he's saying to us, if Imam ordered me to become a judge in a small village or a small area in Iran, I would do it in a heartbeat. Okay? This is the level of person we're talking about. We have Maraje, we have Ayatollah Uzma,
yes.
we have,
yes.
and these, they are all, you know, we kiss their hand, and they,
yes,
have,
of course
they are the ones that we follow when
yeah.
we're talking. And then you have somebody like Imam, who's just on a totally different level. He's marja, he's alim, he's faqih, he's arif, and then he's a leader. He's a leader of humanity. He's a leader of people, of societies, of the ummah. Not only does he teach it and discuss it on a scholarly level, he implements it. He lives it.
He lives it.
Okay, this is the difference. This is why we are. This is what we're so lacking in the world of Islam.
We are.
We sit around. Even the good ones. We sit around. We talk a lot. We have it all figured out theoretically, but nobody takes action. It's about action. Islam is about what you do.
Do.
Okay. You can have all the laws memorized. You can have the entire Quran memorized. You can know the history of the Prophet, peace be upon him, backwards. If you don't act on it, if you don't implement it in your life, it doesn't. There's no point
to it all,
right? Yeah. This is the, as they say, muqaddama. It's the introduction to you acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
When a man like Imam is threatened by the most powerful
government
forces in the earth, he doesn't fold. This is what the Prophet did.
Yes,
the Prophet was being threatened by everyone around him.
Mm-hmm.
Quraysh, they tried to buy him off.
They threatened him.
They killed the people around him.
Yeah.
You know, they banished him.
That's right.
They boycotted him. They imposed economic sanctions.
Sanctions on him. Yes, that sounds very similar.
You know,
very familiar.
The babies were dying in Shebe Abu Talib. The two years that they were living in the desert.
That's
before they went to Medina.
Yes,
the kids were dying because of a lack of medication. Gee, sounds familiar, right?
Yes.
And so he stood firm, the Prophet, peace be upon him. You had similar things happening to the Imams, Imam Ali alayhi salam being the prime example of this. You have, of course, the issues that are surrounded Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the time of, you know, Muawiyah and Yazid. And so, you know, these are the ones we follow, and this is who Imam followed. The example of our leaders, of our religious leaders. Of our divine leaders.
Divine leaders.
The Prophet and the Imams.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Khomeini lived it.
Yes.
He showed to us that it's possible to do this and to be successful and to die as a man who has complete calmness in his heart and who has maintained his dignity throughout his life. There's a famous story they talk about, and you have to imagine Iran at that time, at the time of the Shah, which is, you know, it's the king, right?
Mm.
Wherever he goes, you stand up, you bow, you kiss his hand.
Yeah.
You know, as we still have today in some countries.
Yes, we do. Yes,
you know, you have to do the
very familiar part.
You have to do the little curtsy, and you have to do the little whatever.
Especially if you're going to receive a knighthood. You know,
right. So you know, these things are imperial traditions.
Yes, of course.
And you know, not very Islamic.
No,
just you know, putting it out there for discussion.
Sure.
So, there's a famous story about the Shah saying, "I want to visit the ulama in Qom." This is maybe, you know, 15, 20 years before the. Maybe a little bit more before the revolution. And in an imperial society, in a royal society, this is like the big deal. The Shah is coming to visit. Oh my God. You know, this is it. All right? So the Shah enters the room. All the ulama get up, and Imam doesn't get up. You have to imagine. This is at the peak of the Shah's power.
Yes.
He is the king. You know, you have to throw yourself at his feet.
They're talking about Savak, one of the most ruthless.
Exactly.
Yeah, secret police that was operating here in this country.
You know, people being thrown out of helicopters
and disappearing in
the salt.
Not far here from Qom.
Right,
you know,
disappearing
the
in the salt lakes of you know, around Qom, whatever.
Qom, yeah.
So, you know, here's a man. He comes to visit. And his visit is not, you know, he says, I want, out of respect. Well, it's not out of respect.
Out of respect.
It's a threat.
It's
saying,
threat.
Listen, I know you guys. I'm here. You better acknowledge me.
Mm.
You better kiss the hand. Right? So he's coming there, everybody gets up, Imam doesn't get up. That's it. You know, the example we brought was at the time of the revolution, even before the revolution. You know, this is at the
he's
height
an extraordinary man.
At the height of the power of the king, he stands, you know, and they're in the same room.
Mm.
It's not like some
theoretical
opposition.
Yeah.
He's saying to the king, look, I don't have to stand for you.
Yeah. And who are you anyway?
Right. Who are you anyway? So to, you know, summarize all this.
Yes,
we have a man and an example which is unique. It's truly unique.
It's truly unique. I
okay.
think so, yeah.
We had the privilege and Allah blessed us to be able to
see a
person like that.
Yes. And live in his time.
Right. And thus, after that, everything changed for us.
It did.
We can no longer be the way we were before.
That's true.
Okay?
That's true.
This is the point. This is the point of what Supreme Leader is talking about when he talks about that he's on the level or very close to the level of the prophets and the awliya, that he changed humanity, he changed humans.
Mm-hmm.
It was more than just, you know, as big a deal as, you know, ending 2,500 years of, you know, monarchy.
Because that's what we're seeing. This is not a narrow dynamic change just in the events of history. We are talking about something very, very fundamental.
It's a profound change.
Yes, it's a very profound change.
After, you know, the world before Imam is very different than the world
after.
Well,
after the Imam.
And especially in the Muslim world,
yes.
Especially among Muslims. But even non-Muslims, you have many cases and stories, and, you know, you've seen them yourselves in your life.
Of course, yes.
Where people who had nothing to do with Islam were completely, you know,
mesmerized
by Imam, and their lives changed after that. You know, people, and we saw them. And we know them, and they are still living, and they can bear witness themselves more than we can. But we saw them, that their life changed because of Imam and the things he said and the things he did. And, you know, I think a lot of what we see today in the world, whether it's related to Islamic awakening, and this is something the Supreme Leader has mentioned many times, whether it's related to Islamic awakening, whether it's related to just this general idea of Muslims believing in Islam and wanting to have their own way of living and governing and lifestyle, as opposed to this imposed Western lifestyle. A lot of what we see, even in so-called third world countries, in places like Asia or Africa or Latin America, this rebirth in terms of, you know, having your own institutions, becoming major players in the world, and not simply becoming, you know, colonial subjects or, you know, appendages to the West. I think a lot of that, Imam contributed greatly to this thinking. Even for non-Muslims, they saw Imam as a leader of a, you know, third world country, so-called, a leader of a liberation movement, a leader that stood up to imperialism, mainly American imperialism, and was able to, you know, establish a successful nation. And again, even if we take the standards by which the West measures these things, we're not even talking about by our own standards, the Islamic standards by which we say that Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, has been successful. Even if we take the materialistic Western standards, if you look at the way this country has developed, you know, materially, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of education, in terms of having an educated and capable population, in terms of its scientific achievements, in terms of its medical achievements, even if you take those, you will see that Imam's way was successful and led to the betterment of the life of tens of millions of people.
Thank you for that, Dr. Mahdi Tarawi, a very valuable contribution today on the program. And it only leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening today.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
June 10, a political prisoner serving a life sentence in Bahrain died after contracting COVID-19. The tiny kingdom in the Persian Gulf has come under pressure from human rights organizations over poor prison conditions. Since the March outbreak of the disease in Bahrain's main prison, Jowl, families have been holding protests demanding the release of political prisoners and better conditions, all in vain. The 48-year-old prisoner, a Shia Muslim, was taken from prison to Salmania Hospital on May 29 and was placed on a ventilator in an ICU unit. Shortly after, he slipped into a coma and died a few days later. Hossein Barakat was sentenced in 2018, along with 53 other individuals, to life in prison in a mass trial of 138 Bahraini citizens due to their opposition to the regime's decades-old discrimination and tyranny. He was also stripped of his citizenship, which was later restored by royal decree. Reportedly, there were 15 prisoners in Barakat's cell, which had only 10 beds, hence some of the inmates had to sleep on the floor. Bahraini human rights activist Mariam Khawaja, whose own father is imprisoned in jail, said Barakat told his wife during his last phone call that he could not breathe and was going to die. The fact is, since the outbreak of the coronavirus inside Bahrain prisons, preventative measures inside prisons have not been implemented, and the authorities continue the policy of deliberate medical neglect.
They are known for their unhealthy environments and lack of basic necessities, especially at this dire time and at this crucial time of the pandemic outbreak. And those prisoners, as we know, normal patients, these people who are outside the prison suffer a lot. So what about those who are in prison who already are suffering?
Meanwhile, dissolved Bahraini opposition group Al-Wafaq has been calling for the release of prisoners of conscience since the start of the pandemic. According to Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain, a second outbreak at Jowl began on the 22nd of May and has infected an estimated 60% of the 255 political prisoners housed at Building 12 of the prison. An earlier outbreak in March saw at least 140 inmates infected with the virus. Byrd estimates that the total number of COVID cases in both Jowl and the Dry Dock Detention Center has far exceeded 200 cases since March.
This, of course, amounts to a deliberate killing, to a political assassination, as if the government of Bahrain, if not murdering those prisoners during torture, during executions, it's now dealing with the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic as an opportunity to revenge against those political prisoners, merely because those political prisoners, those peaceful protesters, political activists, human rights defenders, clerics.
Speaking from inside the Dry Dock Detention Center, inmate Ali Al-Haji said, "Most prisoners are mistreated, physically and mentally. It's always the same thing, torture and a lack of proper medical care." Particular concern has been raised about the aging leaders of the 2011 pro-democracy uprising, including Hassan Molshema, who is in his 80s and suffers serious health conditions, placing him at high risk from coronavirus.
The only crime of those political prisoners is that they have called for an elected government, for a constitutional monarchy, for a new constitution which guarantees their rights, their freedoms, which tolerates all citizens equally.
In the words of Hussein Abdullah, executive director of ADHRB, following this tragic death, the Biden administration and the UK government must make clear to their Bahraini allies that holding political opponents as hostages will no longer be tolerated.
The Bahraini government deal with the political prisoners, more than 3,000 political prisoners, as hostages. It neglects their rights merely because those people have once took to the streets and called for their basic freedoms, their basic rights. So it's the same practice as the practices of the Zionist of your fires against the Palestinians. They have a lot of commonalities between those two parties. So they deal with those people as they are hostages. They neglect their rights.
Hossein Barakat's son, Ali Barakat, is also serving a 22-year sentence in jail. After being convicted on political charges in a separate case when he was just 16. Despite an earlier outbreak of COVID-19 at the prison in March and April 2021, the prison administration had still failed to distribute face masks or hand sanitizer to protect prisoners. Overcrowding in Bahrain's prisons is a long-standing concern which makes social distancing impossible. In early April, inmates at Bahrain's Jao prison protested against the lack of medical treatment and fearing for their lives after the death of another inmate. Prison authorities instead threw stun grenades, beating inmates with batons to force them back inside their overcrowded cells.
The inmates have been protesting about conditions of detention, in particular the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in began on 5th April. After a political prisoner, Aba Malala, died after reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. The lack of health care in the overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, but has become a chronic problem during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hossein Barakat's death could have been avoided had the Bahraini regime heeded calls to set free political prisoners so as to prevent the spread of the virus.
Victim Hossein Barakat hasn't been the first victim who passed inside the Bahraini prisoners. We have a lot of cases. We have Martin Karim Sahrawi, who died in prison and because of torture. We have the case of Sayyid Qasim al-Sahlawi. Also, we have the case of Martin Muhammad Sahwan, who had like mostly 80 shrapnels in his head because of the riot police. There are a lot of cases of prisoners who passed away inside those notorious prisons merely because of torture, of medical neglect.
With overcrowded cells, unsanitary conditions, and a lack of preventative measures, this disastrous outbreak seems to continue and claim more lives of those whose only crime was calling for freedom and democracy.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Four Saudis who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Mark Mazzetti, Julian Barnes, and Michael LaForgia. The piece is titled, Saudi Operatives Who Killed Khashoggi Received Paramilitary Training in United States.
Mm-hmm.
more Saudi nationals who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The instruction occurred as the secret unit responsible for Mr. Khashoggi's killing was beginning an extensive campaign of kidnapping, detention, and torture of Saudi citizens, ordered by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, to crush dissent inside the kingdom. The training was provided by the Arkansas-based security company Tier 1 Group, which is owned by the private equity firm Cerberus Capital Management. The company says the training, including safe marksmanship and countering an attack, was defensive in nature and devised to better protect Saudi leaders. One person familiar with the training said it also included work in surveillance and close quarters battle. There is no evidence that the American officials who provided the training or Tier 1 Group executives knew that the Saudis were involved in the crackdown inside Saudi Arabia. But the fact that the government approved high-level military training for operatives who went to carry out the grisly killing of a journalist shows how intensely intertwined the United States has become with an autocratic nation, even as its agents committed horrific human rights abuses. It also underscores the perils of military partnerships with repressive governments and demonstrates how little oversight exists for those forces after they return home. Such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. The U.S. State Department initially granted a license for the paramilitary training of the Saudi Royal Guard to Tier 1 Group starting in 2014 during the Obama administration. The training continued during at least the first year of former President Donald J. Trump's term in office. Louis Bremer, a senior executive of Cerberus Capital Management, Tier 1 Group's parent company, confirmed his company's role in the training last year in written answers to questions from lawmakers as part of his nomination for a top Pentagon job during the Donald Trump administration. The administration does not appear to have sent the document to Congress before withdrawing Mr. Bremer's nomination. Lawmakers never received answers to their questions. In the document, which Louis Bremer provided to the New York Times, he said that four members of the Khashoggi kill team had received Tier 1 Group training in 2017, and two of them had participated in a previous iteration of the training, which went from October of 2014 until January of 2015. The training provided was unrelated to their subsequent heinous acts, Louis Bremer said in his responses. He said that a March 2019 review by Tier 1 Group uncovered no wrongdoing by the company and confirmed that the established curriculum training was unrelated to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Mr. Louis Bremer said that the State Department, in collaboration with other U.S. departments and agencies, is responsible for vetting the foreign forces trained on U.S. soil. All foreign personnel trained by the Tier 1 Group are cleared by the U.S. government for entry into the United States before commencement of their training. In a statement, Louis Bremer said that the training was protective in nature and that the company conducted no further training of Saudis after December of 2017. The Tier 1 group management, the board, and I stand firmly with the U.S. government, the American people, and the international community in condemning the horrific murder of Jamal Khashoggi, he said. A 2019 column by David Ignatius of Washington Post first reported that members of the Khashoggi kill team had received training in the United States. David Ignatius wrote that the CIA had cautioned other government agencies that some special operations training may have been conducted by Tier 1 group under a U.S. State Department license. The issue was central to Mr. Luis Bremer's contentious confirmation hearing and the written questions from senators asking him what role, if any, Tier 1 group had in training Saudi nationals who had participated in the Jamal Khashoggi operation. A State Department spokesman declined to confirm whether it awarded licenses to Tier 1 group for the Saudi training. This administration insists on responsible use of U.S. origin defense equipment and training by our allies and partners, and considers appropriate responses if violations occur, said the spokesman Ned Price. Saudi Arabia faces significant threats to its territory, and we are committed to working together to help Riyadh strengthen its defenses. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Saudi embassy in Washington did not comment. Former President Donald Trump weighed installing the head of Cerberus Capital Management, Steven Feinberg, in a top intelligence post last year, but the appointment was never made. While the Trump administration had appointed Mr. Feinberg to lead the president's intelligence advisory board in 2018, questions emerged about potential conflicts of interest. Cerberus Capital Management formerly owned the military contractor DynCorp, which among other things provides intelligence advice to the United States and other clients. It is unclear which members of the Khashoggi kill team participated in the Tier 1 group training. Seven members of the team belong to an elite unit charged with protecting the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, according to an American intelligence report about the assassination declassified in February. The role of operatives from the so-called Rapid Intervention Force in the Khashoggi killing helped bolster the American intelligence case that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the operation. Members of the Rapid Intervention Force would not have participated in the killing without his consent, according to the report. The group exists to defend the Saudi Crown Prince and answers only to him, the document said. Members of the team that killed Jamal Khashoggi were involved in at least a dozen operations starting in 2017, according to officials who have read declassified intelligence reports about the campaign. Mr. Khashoggi, a columnist for the Washington Post, was killed inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. His body was dismembered using a bone saw. The assassination brought widespread condemnation of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who tried to deny any knowledge of the operation. Eight defendants were sentenced to up to 2 decades in prison last year, but human rights advocates criticized the punishments as aimed at lower-level agents while sparing their leaders. The CIA concluded that the Saudi Crown Prince directed the operation, but Donald Trump said the evidence was inconclusive and that America's diplomatic and economic relationship with Saudi Arabia took priority. After President Joe Biden took office and debated the issue with his advisors before the release of the declassified intelligence report, his administration announced sanctions on Saudi citizens involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, including members of the elite unit who protect the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. but President Joe Biden chose not to directly punish the Saudi crown prince. The earlier iteration of the training, which took place during the Obama administration, occurred before Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman consolidated his power in the kingdom. His predecessor as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was a close ally of the United States and in particular of John O. Brennan, who served as CIA Director General under President Barack Obama. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was the Saudi counterterrorism chief and collaborated closely with the Obama administration officials. In 2017, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman pushed Prince Mohammed bin Nayef from power and executed a broader campaign to wrest power from his rivals, including a notorious episode of imprisoning Saudi royals and businessmen at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. The Trump administration considered him a valuable partner in the Middle East, and Prince Mohammed bin Salman developed a close relationship with Jared Kushner. The former president's son-in-law, who served as a senior advisor to Donald Trump. Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the son of King Salman, is the next in line to the Saudi throne. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef remains under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. The Tier 1 group website lists numerous American special operations and intelligence units as clients, along with specialty units that do not require recognition. It said it also trains OGA special operator teams, one pseudonym for CIA paramilitary units, as well as international allied forces. Under federal rules that restrict foreign sales of American arms and military expertise, Tier 1 group was required to apply for licenses to train the foreign operatives. Those license applications were examined by State Department officials who were processing tens of thousands of licenses per year, and they were approved. The approval would have allowed members of the Saudi Royal Guard to enter the United States on visas processed by the American Embassy in Riyadh. The path is similar to the one followed by Second Lieutenant Mohammad al-Shamrani, a Royal Saudi Air Force officer who opened fire in 2019 at a naval air station in Pensacola, Florida, where he was receiving military flight training. That attack killed at least 3 people and wounded 8 others.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. سلام عليكم, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batool. Welcome to the program for a better life. The question that I would like to ask you is, what is a better life? What do we mean by a better life? Is it having a big house, a nice car, a nice job, a beautiful spouse, a good bank balance? If the answer is yes, then why do we see people who possess all this are still striving for more and more and more and more? They're not satisfied at all. In my opinion, the key to a better life is being happy. Now, how can a person reach happiness? A person might be wealthy, but still not happy. So what is the secret to happiness? The secret is to have God in your life. So how can I have God in my life? We can have God in our lives by making our actions, our thoughts, our intentions godly, by maintaining piety, by acquiring virtues, and cleansing ourselves from all the vices. This will lead to eternal bliss. The first step is to clean ourselves from inside, to discipline ourselves. Once we are purified, then we can replace our vices with virtues. So, now, the question is, how do I purify myself? How do I discipline myself? Is there a plan? Are there any guidelines for it? Yes, the ulama of akhlaq have given a few pointers. But before that, I would like to pose a few questions. Question one. Now, how is a society formed? The answer is with families. Next question. How are families formed? Families are formed with individuals like you and me. So if you and I, we correct ourselves, the society will automatically be corrected. If we bring that change in ourselves, that will lead to the change in the society, which in turn will lead to happiness, the eternal bliss, the better life. So, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. Imam Ali alayhis salam said, Man lam yuslih nafsahu, lam yuslih ghayrahu. One who cannot correct himself cannot correct others. So how do we correct ourselves? What are the steps towards it? The first step is called yaqda. Yaqda is derived from the root word yaqd, which means to awaken, to have awareness. In Irfan, it means to wake up from a deep slumber, which results in lightening of the heart with the godly light, to turn towards Allah by turning away from this world.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We are all awake, but this awakening that I'm talking about is something else. Prophet said, "An-nasu niyam, fa idha matu intabahu." People are sleeping. When they will die, they will wake up. And when they will wake up, they will never sleep again. But it will be too late. As a matter of fact, it will be like the last train has left. Oh Allah, send me back. I'll do some good deeds. I'll give me another chance. Then Allah will say, Innaha kalimatun huwa qailuha. He's just saying. He doesn't mean what he's saying. These are mere words. That is why, brothers and sisters, we should wake up before it is too late. Sometimes an incident might awaken a person. For example, he loses a loved one, God forbid, or there is some loss in his business, in his work, a layoff, or a disease, or an awakening sentence from a pious one. Ayatollah Amini writes in his book, Self-Building, that Abu Basir narrates. Abu Basir gives us this story where he says, one of the agents of a tyrant king used to live in my neighborhood, who used to acquire his living through illegal means. That means he used to have all his living through haram and had turned his home into a center of carnal pleasures. What did he mean by that? That means there was dancing, drinking, music. And Abu Basir continues, he says, living next door to him was annoying and painful for me, but there was no alternative except to bear, because my repeated advices had not had any impact in his behavior. There was no improvement at all. Finally, one day, when I pressed him hard to change his lifestyle, he replied, I am a prisoner of Satan. Because of my addiction to eating, drinking, and sinning, I cannot quit it. I am a sick person, and I have no treatment. You are a good neighbor to me, but I am a bad neighbor for you. I am helpless. I have become a prisoner of self-whims and passions, and don't know what to and how to get myself out of this. See, brothers and sisters, don't we do that? Don't we make excuses when we don't want to stop sinning? When we have a bad habit, we always look for excuses. This is what that neighbor was doing. And then Abu Basir continues his story. He says that the neighbor told him, he said, when you visit Imam al-Sadiq in the near future, please plead my case to him. Maybe he will suggest a solution. Then Abu Basir continues, he says, I was deeply influenced with his words and remained patient for a while till an opportunity arose for me to go to Medina for seeing Imam al-Sadiq. When I saw Imam al-Salam, I told him the story of my neighbor. The Imam replied, when you return, your neighbor will come to see you. Then you must tell him that Ja'far ibn Muhammad had said, do not commit sins and I will guarantee paradise for you. Just imagine, brothers and sisters, isn't that a moving line? It's such a powerful sentence that Imam said. He said, do not commit sins and I will guarantee paradise for you. Now let's see what happened to the rest of the story, like what happened to the neighbor after he heard this, inshallah, in our next session. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
Your mercy, your love is on me. All I need, all I need, all I need, all I need. All I need.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.